Hello and welcome to This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger, Director of Editorial for Citywire USA, and I'm joined by Ian Wenick, Editor of Citywire RAA, and Andrew Forsch, Deputy Editor of Citywire RAA. And guys, it's great to be back, frankly. I've not been in the hot seat for about a month now. I think I was here maybe in listeners' ears last week, but that episode was recorded, pre-recorded. And yeah, we haven't all been together in the studio for a while. So I would ask how you've been. I mean, I've seen you all obviously since, but good to be back, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm back in my flow state, regularly scheduled programming. I'm in my normal seat. You know, it's nice to be able to kind of discuss the news again. As much as I love having guests on, I like having our regular dynamic back.
Yeah, absolutely. And nice to have Andrew with us all the way from Washington, D.C. Everything all right down there?
All good over here. Yeah, business as usual. Nice to have you back and the terrific trio here again.
That's what people call us. Absolutely. That's
many wide, people are saying
wide,
that.
Widely used. Definitely not just there for the first time ever. I also realized that, guys, big omission in the running order here, but we haven't got a dedicated sports section, and probably for the first time ever, I feel overqualified in the sports, because I'm sure as you've all been paying attention to, the mighty Three Lions are roaring through this World Cup. So let's find some time at the end to indulge that, you know, as I often have in the past, sat through whole 3 minutes on baseball and let that sail over my head. Excellent. Well, look, glad you're all back. Glad to be back myself. Let's get into it. And we've got a doozy of a story to kick off with, Ian. So this broke, I suppose, toward the end of last week, but very much still in this week, as in the last few days. Doozy of a story from you about Fidelity Investments. And the crux of the story is that at some point last year, they had internal conversations about the idea, possibly, maybe, of thinking about conceptually what it would be like to, you know, invest in RAAs. And the reason I've hedged there is that subsequent to our publication of that story, they sort of came back and said, actually, you know, we are going to deny those claims, or we don't like the way you've framed this. But yeah, let's talk about that story. What was it? What happened? What they're saying? And then we'll use that as a bit of a jumping off point to talk more about the relationships between custodians at a higher level and RAAs.
Yeah, so I think just to put this in context at a high level, I was told last week by several sources with direct knowledge of the situation that in late 2025, Fidelity, they ran a broader view of the relationship between private equity firms and the wealth management industry. This is under the purview of a gentleman named Gary Gallagher, who is now the president at iCapital, an alternative investments platform. So Gary Gallagher was the head of strategic business development for Fidelity's institutional business, and that was a job that had him managing Fidelity's RA custody units' relationships with private equity firms and platform service providers and tech companies and other kinds of strategic partners. And so as part of this review that Gary Gallagher carried out, Fidelity had, I was told by several sources, at least some internal discussion about making minority investments into RAAs themselves. And we can get into the reasons why that'd be a logical step for them. And then ultimately the decision was Fidelity had some informational conversations with private equity firms and other kinds of capital providers, but ultimately decided not to move forward with the idea. And there are no current plans for Fidelity to pursue such an idea.
Okay, and that's what you were told, and we went to them and said this, and we won't get into all the back and forth, but effectively sort of after publication, they then said, actually, like, we don't necessarily agree with how you have framed that. We would say these were just very high-level conversations, part of this broader piece of work around private equity and the wider wealth management industry, and if this came up, it was only at a very conceptual level. That's their stance on it. Is that fair?
They just said that if they had discussions about this, it would be theoretical in nature. And the way that it was described to me was that this was kind of a high level internal, kind of like a brainstorming session. And, you know, it would make, we'll get into why, but yeah, it makes it they'd at least consider this.
Okay, so let's say that. Let's take some of this thing out of this, which is like, okay, on the one hand, look, yeah, if they were to have be more concrete conversations or anything, that would be a big story. We'll get into why that would be somewhat contentious, at least for some RIAs. But at the same time, actually, like, it's not a crazy thing. It's not actually that wild for a company like them, with the relationships that they have with RIAs, with the role that they have had in the growth of many RIAs, to then look at saying, well, hang on, you know, and also, like, just with what's gone on with PE in the RIA space, something that we've, you know, probably, if we haven't literally written the book on, we're pretty close to at this point in terms of the number of stories. Yeah, you know, it's not wild for them, given that they are, what, the second largest custodian, given that their referral network or program is hugely coveted. If you're a part of that referral program and you're one of the firms that does well out of that, you've probably, that's been your biggest growth driver of the last X many years. You let's say you are one of those firms, you look a hugely attractive business to a PE firm, given your organic growth levels. And we know organic growth is something that a lot of RIAs actually do struggle with. You could command a great valuation from a PE firm. And so it's not wild for Fidelity to say, actually, we've been a big reason behind that growth. Why would we not want to capture some of that economics that everyone else is capturing, right?
Yes. I mean, I think the direct analogy that I make, if you're a longtime listener to the This Week in Wealth podcast or a long-term reader of citywire.com/RIA.
One of the best URLs you can get. If anyone wants to buy it of us, obviously, just message.
Then you'll know that we've discussed a similar dynamic around the context of LPL Financial, the nation's largest independent broker-dealer. And LPL has had a long-term relationship with a lot of these firms called OSJs, Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction. Super quick, 15 seconds. These are RIA entities that use LPL's brokerage platform or custodial platform, and they're usually fairly large, and LPL generally provides them with preferential pricing or recruiting assistance. And so a couple years ago, LPL sought to change the master service agreements, which govern the relationships between LPL and the OSJs. And a lot of it was kind of prompted by the fact that a lot of these OSJs have achieved 9 to 10 figure valuations from investment from private equity firms or other institutions, largely off the back of LPL's assistance. And so it makes sense that Fidelity, look, it's, we'll get into the nuances here, but, you know, these firms have grown into $1 billion firms, $5 billion firms, $10 billion plus enterprise valuation firms, a lot of times off the backs of referrals that Fidelity and Schwab provide and the back office and middle office support that the custodians provide. Like, the custodians aren't charities, they're businesses too.
Yeah, so, and again, like, let's move us away from Fidelity to fend off any, you know, complaint emails or calls. You know, just at a theoretical level, custodian X, if you have that referral program, yeah, as you say, similar thing with LPL, where, like, some of those OSJs have benefited from preferential terms, yes, benefited from recruitment benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have literally seen them then, yeah, sell their stakes to someone else who in 7 years' time will sell that stake again for 3, 4, 5, you know, X on what they originally put in. And so it's not, yeah, you're seeing basically other people get fat off businesses that you've helped build.
Exactly.
Why would you, custodian X or support services provider Y or broker dealer Z, not think, could I get a slice of that? I suppose the other thing to say is, if we stick with custodians, and we use some real names here, Fidelity, Schwab, they obviously compete with RIAs in other ways too, as is well known. They obviously both, the whole reason why they have these referral programs is because they also have these massive advisory businesses, these massive brokerage businesses, which, you know, bring in clients, and then when they get too big or too complicated, they refer them out. But, you know, they have a big wealth management business already, basically.
Yeah, that's the tension, is that these custodians are already, Schwab and Fidelity are already essentially in direct competition with RIAs for clients. And we've seen this kind of manifest in the way that the custodians have tightened the requirements to be in the referral programs. They're choosing to keep a lot of that, those clients, wholly for themselves now. Yeah, it's a lot harder to get referrals out.
Obviously, like last year in this, around some of the great reporting that you guys and Sam did on Schwab's changes to its referral program.
Exactly.
And sort of trying to keep more of that economics. There was a story also earlier this year, wasn't there, around Schwab expanding its sort
wealth
of
advisory network,
which is a slightly different.
Yes, those are
part of its advice, is different from the pure brokerage network. And so sort of,
those are fully in-house wealth management offices.
Okay, so again, that's a sort of a little area where there's competition. And I think you put this in your story. If you didn't, we certainly talked about it. But Schwab also indirectly does actually invest in RIAs.
Because Schwab is a position in Dynasty Financial Partners, which is a middle and back office RIA service provider. And Dynasty itself is a minority investor in RIAs. So if you really kind of look at it critically, Schwab already has indirect exposure to this exact type of investing dynamic.
Obviously, those two big custodians don't actually invest directly in RIAs, and you could see the issues that would throw up beyond the existing conflicts of interest, beyond the existing sort of tensions that exist between them and their custodian clients, if they were to then have stakes in, let's say, some of the larger members of their referral program. Other members of their referral program would probably go, well, hang on a second, am I still getting the goods? Are you not going to favor these guys that you have a more, you know, have a more direct interest in and stuff? So obviously it would be contentious. And just to repeat, their assertion is that they only ever spoke about this at a very sort of theoretical conceptual level.
It is also, if I can just chime in, super quick point, just a footnote, basically. Like, I think it's worth noting that both Schwab and Fidelity are direct stakeholders in, like, fintech platforms and technology vendors that serve RIAs. And there's obviously there's one obvious reason for that, which is those platforms make it easier and more efficient for RIAs on those platforms to operate. I think Schwab backs Wealth.com, which is an estate planning platform. So if you're on the Schwab platform, maybe you get some access to that. I don't exactly know. But the other angle to that is that's another line of exposure to the growth of the RIA landscape. I mean, as the industry grows and these companies that use these tech vendors grow, those vendors do well, and Schwab and Fidelity are positioned to capture some economics there. Fidelity backs some kind of account aggregation platforms. So all of this to say, it wouldn't shock me if the custodians tried to kind of widen out the surface area of their exposure to this business model.
Yeah, no, that, I think that's a very fair point. And I mean, obviously, to be fair, we should also take a step back. I mean, they've already benefited hugely from it, haven't they? I mean, you know, let's go back, let's just go back 10 years because it's easy. You know, I don't have any numbers to hand. I'll be impressed, but I'm not expecting you to. Just to how big the RIA space was in terms of firms and assets and how big it is now. And, you know, as we know, those two firms have a huge market share of the custody business there. So, they have already obviously benefited hugely from the growth of the RIA space. But yeah, I think we can all see it only going one way at the moment. And why wouldn't you think about that more? Anything else, Ian, that you wanted to come in on this before we move on to item two?
Just as I like to say with some of these stories, the full story has not been written yet. I'm saying more reporting to come on a lot of these topics we just discussed.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. Well, you know where to find those stories. That catchy URL again, cityyreusa.com/RIA. Now, Andrew, you've joined us. You've been mostly patient. You very helpfully chimed in at the end. But you joined
us
also.
It's a polite way of saying I've been relatively dead weight on the
saying at all. I'm trying to smoothly segue to item two, which is a big story that you broke, again, just before we all down tools for the 4th of July weekend. You broke a big story about two exits from Osaic. I was going to say, where's Osaic rank in terms of the broker-dealer league? Is it
they're
LPL?
Probably
number two, number three?
I guess it's three.
Are they two?
Probably behind Cetera and they're probably close to Cetera, but behind
Ameriprise,
LPL.
Yeah. We should probably check this.
Ameriprise up there too, yeah.
Okay. Not in, well, look, reader, if you're interested, AI exists. We'll put a footnote in on this. Anyway, Andrew, Osaic, massive broker dealer and a couple of massive exits.
Yeah, that was certainly a nice way to close out the reporting week before the long holiday weekend there. But yeah, the story is this. Two top Osaic executives stepped down and left the company, and they are Greg Kornick, who was the vice president of wealth management solutions, and Christy Britt, who was the chief financial officer. And so they both have departed the company. And they are kind of the latest in a long spell of executive exits from Osaic recently. And we can get into some of those. But I'm sorry to say I don't have a ton more than was in the written article to kind of say about the circumstances
around
their exits.
Come on.
No, but it is interesting. Kornick specifically had his role changed a handful of times in what might to the outside eye look like demotions. I don't think it's unfair to say that. He was previously Mosaic's president. He had been on since 2020. He was overseeing kind of advisor recruiting and the growth of the various advisor teams. I think Mosaic might have 11,000 advisors on the platform. So it's a huge business, obviously. And it was a really big and important remit, obviously, for Kornick. And at the start of 2025, he played a really big role in Osaic's kind of consolidation effort to bring its formerly disparate eight broker-dealer subsidiaries, and Kornick played a really big role in Osaic's effort over the last couple of years to consolidate those, rebrand away from the previous advisor group name, and become one, you know, unified business. And so at the start of 2025, his title changed. He went from being the company's president to its executive vice president of advice and wealth management. And he held that title for about 6 months. And then he had another title change, becoming the company's executive vice president of wealth management solutions. And why that's important is basically his job shifted away from working directly with Osaic's advisors to working on, you know, its wealth management platform. That's a big change. And so I'll pause there for follow-up questions.
Yeah, that really interesting. And so, well, we don't, yeah, demotions, sideways moves. We're not, I guess we're not entirely clear on those, but yeah, a lot of change there. And he's gone. Ian, did you have anything on Kornick? Are you...
No, just because, like, I think Andrew made a good point, which is that his role had been shifted considerably over time as the company grew.
Okay.
But I do think we had had some, I mean, he was once viewed as a potential successor for you know, even more important positions. I mean, Jamie Price has been CEO for a while. There's no indication that that's changing anytime soon. But it was once thought, I think Kornick was once considered to be a top internal candidate for, you know, a future CEO seat if one were to open up.
Okay. Wow. So, yeah, so a very notable exit. And the other exit?
CFO Christy Britt. She came on in 2024. She was previously the head of finance at Reuters, and she was a long tenured executive there. And so, yeah, she also has left. Now, the timing of these exits is also interesting, given that Osaic just recently recapitalized, that deal. So the company is backed by Reverence Capital Partners, a private equity firm. They've been majority controlling owner of Osaic for quite some time now. And they recently did a recapitalization deal. I think it was $2 billion in new committed capital. Reverence stays in, extends its time horizon, and a bunch of really big private equity names came in for the first time as investors in Osaic. Among them, Ares, Bain. There's some secondaries funds managed by Lexington Partners that came in. We've talked about this deal, I believe, on this podcast before. So
that's right. And Reverence sort of set up a continuation vehicle, is that right? To kind of
yes.
keep their awesome.
And they brought some new money in.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There was a cross fund investment. There was another, kind of tranche of buy in from Mosaic's own advisors and executives. And yeah, it was a big deal. And so they recapped, and now, you know, a little bit of an executive shuffle after that. I don't want to draw too bold of a line between those events, but the timing certainly is something at least to look at and think about maybe.
Okay. So yeah, sort of eyes on what happens next, whether there's sort of further C-suite shuffles. Have they named replacements for any of these roles that we know of at the moment, or
the only thing that I've seen, and maybe I ought to take another look, it's been a couple of days now, but the only thing that I saw was Osaic's former executive VP of operations and technology got a promotion up to chief product and operations officer. So obviously filling in a C-suite role. So he got a nice promotion, kind of rising up the negative space there from the aforementioned
No new CFO has been named as of
Not yet. At least not that I have seen. I should take a look at that before we end the pod recording here.
Ian, if you could pad for time while Andrew does the prep work right, you should have done before, that would be perfect. Okay. While Andrew does his homework on his story, we've got one last item to talk about. And Ian, it's a sort of an update, I suppose, almost on an ongoing story that we've written about this year. So the headline here is that Goldman Sachs is going to launch a long-short SMA strategy for, RIAs using its custodian.
External client base, including platform. RIAs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But also for other advisors. But the context here is key.
Yes. So the context, again, we talked about kind of participating revenue. So super quick primer for people like my mom that don't know what a long short simply managed account is. So a long...
It's not just your mom. I think there's a large cohort of people. But anyway.
Yeah, I know my mom listens. So I want to feel like I'm talking. I want her to feel like I'm talking to her because she's going to listen to this while we're driving down to the beach.
Hi, Mrs. Wenick.
Anyway, so a long short simply managed account is an investment account that mixes a blend of long positions in stocks and short positions in stocks. And the idea is that you use a bit of capital loss harvesting and capital gain deferment to minimize your overall tax liabilities as the overall account grows.
Super and, popular at the moment as one, people have run up massive gains. We've had this huge bull run for God knows how long at this point. And also very popular with sort of executives who might have a lot of stock in one position, but need to obviously start diversifying that portfolio out and therefore sort of selling some of those positions, which again might have run up massive, currently unrealized gains. So
exactly.
An increasingly popular strategy for a lot of RIA clients.
And the issue is that if you're a custodian like a Fidelity or a Charles Schwab or Goldman Sachs, is that those long and short positions sit on your balance sheet. So you have to bear the balance sheet risk of having those short positions, you're kind of exposed to them.
And as we know, obviously, a long position could just go to zero, but a short position can go down and down and down and down and down.
And so as we've seen, companies like Fidelity and Schwab have instituted restrictions on RIAs putting client assets in these long short SMAs, either restrictions on funding new client accounts with them, margin restrictions, client asset minimums. And so Goldman, for context, we reported earlier that they were going to launch their own platform that allows third-party asset managers to place their long short SMAs on the underlying Goldman custodial platform.
So yeah, so again, just one second here. Obviously, as discussed before, the dominant two custodians, Fidelity and Schwab, and they both had these long-short SMA programs, both put restrictions on them. In Fidelity's case, sort of quite heavy-handed at one point, sort of full-on, like, no new clients into these indefinitely, and that's since lifted. Goldman, a much smaller, more nascent player in the custodian space, and obviously saw an opportunity where people couldn't place that business with Fidelity or, to a lesser extent, Schwab for a period, so they thought, hang on, well, why don't we open such a program to win some of this business, did that, and then have thought, well, hang on, why stop there? Why just open this program? We have an asset manager. Why not also offer our own asset management service so we can, again, get more of that economics?
It's the same idea, which is if you're the custodian, you have to bear the balance sheet risk. Why shouldn't they get to participate in the capture some of the asset management revenue? It's a perfectly logical decision.
And they had this strategy already that they had launched and had allowed their, again,
internal
wealth management business.
Yes.
everyone's double, triple, quadruple dipping. So they had that business already. They launched it there. And then they thought, okay, now we're going to have third parties as well.
Exactly. That's the exact idea they're going with.
So latest kind of twist in this ongoing story around long-short SMAs on programs, I guess, on custodian platforms. And we think probably more to come here.
Yes.
Not to tease too much, but we have some tips we've not yet written in this regard.
This is great for our very visual podcast. I just winked.
There you go, yeah. Good. Well, thank you very much, Ian and Andrew. Now, before we go, I tease this at the front, and you're going to have to indulge me for a moment here. Ian, on the last episode, actually, that we did with Kunal, which was recorded in the group stages of the World Cup, I think the day that England had played Croatia, we gave some predictions. My prediction was the unoriginal, very patriotic England all the way for the World Cup. You at the time, I think, predicted Brazil?
Well, I was on the spot. If I'd actually put any thought into it, I would have said France.
Oh, well, it's easy to say now that Brazil's out and France is rocking. But okay, fair enough. So we're into the quarters. We've got eight teams left. Whereas, yeah, your money's on France.
Yeah, I'm fully behind France. They look like a level above most other countries in this tournament. I said most.
That's fine. That's okay. Andrew, do you have a strong opinion? You need to. So come up with one quickly. Who are you tipping of the eight teams left?
He's panicking.
I got to root for the underdog. It's Morocco, baby.
Yeah, that's a good call. That's a fun call. It is a shame that there are a lot of European teams in there. Nothing against the Belgians or the Swiss, but it could have been fun if there had been, dare I say, the USA.
You thought Egypt was advancing. You would have been sorely disappointed.
Yeah, it would have been fun if Egypt had got through as well. But yeah, it does feel... I mean, obviously it's good. Colombia, I thought, could have got through as well. It could have been a slightly more global World Cup. But we are where we are. Listener, you probably didn't tune in for this stuff, so we'll leave it there. But we're very happy to be back. We're all very excited about the World Cup. And we will be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in... Well...